last time I took a road trip? How many national parks could I hit in 2 weeks? What about hotels? Wait, hey, Erica, how much am I spending on travel?
When your questions about life turn into questions about money, there's Erica, the virtual financial assistant to help you spend, save, and plan smarter. Only from Bank of America. What would you like the power to do? Erica is only available in the English language. You must download the latest version of the mobile banking app, only available on select mobile devices. Your chat may be recorded and monitored for quality assurance. Message and data rates and additional terms may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to The Rest Is Money with me, Robert Peston.
And me, Steph McGovern. Now, today's guest, Mariana Mazzucato, might finally be able to answer the question we are constantly asking on this podcast. How do we get growth back in the UK economy? And that's because she's a world-class economist who advises policymakers from Scotland to South Africa, talking about innovation-led, inclusive and sustainable growth. She's worked for the World Health Organization, the EU. She's currently an economics professor at University College London, where she is the founder director of the UCL Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose. Also, her work has apparently inspired Keir Starmer's five missions, hasn't it? Which will form the backbone of Labour's manifesto going into this year's election. So I think she's well placed, isn't she, to tell us whether Rachel Reeves' May's lecture speech to the city had any plans for the economy that she think will work. But we've got lots to ask her on as well, because she's always, you know, she's written loads of great books. We're going to be talking about consultancy with her too, aren't we?
Yep, she's written this book called The Big Con about how the consultancy industry is way out of control and is undermining the fabric of government. She is basically a world-class brainiac and, I mean, just so much to chat with her about.
Yeah.
Great to see you, Mariana. And I just want to start by asking you about Rachel Reeves' obsession with the so-called fiscal rules, the rules that control debt and deficit in government. That's what her May's lecture was largely focused on. Some would say this massively boxes her in when it comes to doing the things that she also claims she wants to do, which is to stimulate growth. What did you make of it?
So the reason I think she's playing that card, I think she's called it securonomics, right?
Yeah.
To reassure the population that progressives and the left and labor know how to deal with the economy and won't run the economy into the ground is, you know, important if you want to reassure. But if you don't have an economic narrative that follows it, the problem is that it can look a bit flimsy. So I think what she should be talking about is that the problem in the UK is we have lagging growth. That is a problem because growth is an outcome of both public and private investment. We have one of the lowest levels of private investment, right? Everyone always obsesses about public investment. We have one of the lowest levels of private investment in the OECD. So if bold, strategic, I would call it mission-oriented public investment can catalyze and crowd in private sector investment, that will actually expand the economy. And that's the denominator of debt to GDP. So I think where sometimes progressives in general, and the Labour Party in particular in the UK, get a bit confused is that if you obsess about the numerator, so some sort of fiscal rule on the debt, on the deficit, and don't actually think about what is the strategic role of public and private sector investment and how to fund that, which will expand the denominator, then you have this ironic situation, which we saw in Southern Europe after the financial crisis, where they obsessed about getting the deficits down, so that you can reduce debt, you can reduce the deficit, but increase debt to GDP. Mm. And that's not hard to understand. It's just basic math. X over zero, you might remember, is infinity.
Right? Well, I mean, some would say that George Osborne made precisely that mistake when he went for austerity back in 2010. And so one of the interesting questions is, given that there are many on the left who recognize the importance of stimulating growth, you know, why it is that we still have such a cautious Labour Party?
So what you've just said about George Osborne, first of all, is an important point, because the austerity that the UK faced after the financial crisis, where we blamed public debt instead of the private debt, which caused the crisis, let's not forget that it was private debt globally that basically burst, and that's what caused the financial crisis. Austerity that we experienced actually caused our social fabric to wither. So the cost of inaction, when we cut everything, social services, health services, transport, public housing, public education, the cost of inaction ultimately is greater than the cost of action. In other words, to pick up the mess that is caused by that austerity actually costs the economy more. So not only is it bad for people and planet, by the way, because of course we need to, you know, make our whole economy more sustainable, and that itself requires public investment. But what we need to remember is, forget people and planet, just the economics of it. It will cost more in the long run by just saving in the short run. And that then, in terms of the what I would call the innovation economy, which is not just, you know, strengthening the social fabric, which is incredibly important. Why? Because it costs more to imprison a young person than to educate them. But the innovation side, which means that we need to be making those kinds of investments that lead to productivity growth, so training of workers, you know, stronger education system, science industry linkages, so on and so forth, that also suffered. And that's what I mean by this kind of lagging public investment in the UK. So the problem is, unless Labour, again, understands the lessons from that, and again, 10 to 15 years of austerity, which this country has experienced, then ultimately, it's also not credible that we will actually achieve what they are now talking about, which is growth, growth, growth. They want to set up or strengthen the growth and enterprise unit within the government. That's all fine. But I don't know any country, literally any country, that has achieved growth by talking about growth.
Yeah. So does that mean then we do need to borrow more in order to invest?
Sure, but don't forget that the government is not like a household, right? So households might go bankrupt, right? Because if you're taking on too much credit and you are not, you know, expanding your ability to create income in terms of the, you know, revenue that's coming into the household. Governments are different, especially governments that have their own sovereign currency, which the UK does. We have the pound. And so as long as you are creating money and borrowing it for a reason that is strategic, which will catalyze growth through that dynamic of public and private investment, which will increase physical capital, human capital, technological and social change, then it's fine because you're expanding productive capacity. If instead you just have helicopter money, so if you're borrowing and just throwing money into the system in a non-strategic way, or for example, how many populist governments have sometimes just created income and, you know, distributed it to the population in a redistributive kind of way without actually creating the wealth that can be redistributed, then of course you'll have a problem. So the problem should not be just looking at the number of the debt to GDP ratio or, you know, whether or not government should borrow. The details matter. So the structure of public investment and its ability to catalyze private sector investment is what matters. So if you borrow for that and if it works, it will pay itself back.
But in the short term, though, wouldn't that weaken us in an international level in terms of the pound and, you know, the bond market and things? Because, you know, obviously, like when Liz Truss did that, you know, Kwasi Kwarteng did this whole thing about putting more money into the economy, it absolutely killed us on the international markets and then ended up with
rates. But that's not what they did. So don't forget that the deficit is, you know, how much money a government is spending compared to how much money it's actually bringing in through tax revenue. Yeah. So what Liz Truss did was just to say, we're going to reduce tax immensely and that will stimulate the economy. And the financial markets are actually quite smart. They know that hasn't worked. If you just reduce tax revenue, that's going to make the government go into debt. And that's very different from what I'm talking about, which is having a public investment program, which you fund through borrowing, which will catalyze economic growth if done well. I repeat, if done well, because there's also old ways to do that. So an old industrial strategy would have just been public borrowing to stimulate, say, growth in particular sectors, which might have captured government by being considered strategic sectors. And that leads to what economists sometimes refer to as the picking winners problem, where government is just kind of throwing money at particular sectors which are deemed to be key or essential, but then it's not actually creating transformation in those sectors, which ultimately is what's required if we care about productivity.
So I just wanted to dig into this a bit. There was this moment, which if I'd been you, I'd have been immensely flattered by, which is Keir Starmer says he's going to have these five missions, because you are the economist who, you know, has written extensively about how governments need missions in order to transform economies to provide the kind of quality of life that citizens feel they deserve and to solve the longer term challenges we face. But you don't think necessarily with all of his missions, he quite gets it. So tell us what you mean by a mission and why, for example, his growth mission isn't quite what you meant.
Right. So I'll start with the quick answer to the last part of your question, which is growth is the result of a mission-oriented approach if it's done well. Growth itself is not the mission. So the reason I wrote the book called Mission Economy, A Moonshot Guide to Changing Capitalism is that I'm deeply convinced that we would never have gotten to the moon today, given how we think about the role of the state today. So when Kennedy made his speech, you'll remember he said, we're doing it because it's hard, not because it's easy. Already that's totally different from any policy wonk paper, which is all about facilitating, de-risking the private sector. He said, we're doing it because it's hard, which is the opposite of facilitating, which means making something easier. I'm Italian, so facile means easy. They had very clear public direction. It was to the moon and back, not just go to the moon and blow up, come back in a short amount of time. It required a huge amount of private sector investment. There was 400,000 people involved in many different sectors, not just aerospace, nutrition, materials, electronics. The first thing they did was change procurement. I've become a complete nerd about procurement because it's a huge chunk of government budgets, and they changed it to be outcomes-oriented, mission-oriented procurement. So instead of cost-plus, where you're just kind of giving out money to the private sector to, you know, do things cheaply, it was outcomes oriented, fixed price, but with incentives for innovation and quality improvement. And they were so bold that they even put into the contracts no excess profits. Not no profits, because you don't get to the moon with charity. You need profits, you need good business, good government working together. That ended up stimulating an immense amount of innovation because they had this outcomes orientation to all the homework problems that had to be solved along the way. The solutions to those homework problems got us camera phones, foil blankets, baby formula, software. So imagine if we applied that approach towards our climate problems around net zero, health and well-being problems in London, a zero knife crime mission, right? Imagine if we actually had an interministerial, interdepartmental approach, first of all, to these problems, because remember, climate is not just for the Department of Energy. Well-being and health is not just for the Department of Health. So it's interdepartmental and intersectoral. All those different sectors had to work with government to solve all the homework problems along the way. The reason that that caused growth in the system, and I've just written a paper about this, how the multiplier, literally the Keynesian multiplier, is greater when public investment is mission-oriented, because it, again, catalyzes solutions to all these homework problems and gets us technology as a result, not as the goal. Now, that means that the missions have to be really clear, bold, and inspirational and catalyze intersectoral investment. So by definition, growth as a mission doesn't mean anything. You want growth to be the result, and you want different types of economic metrics, including productivity, to be monitored along the way. But the key thing, for example, you need is a treasury that even knows how to evaluate this process. And I often say, had the moon landing been evaluated through a cost-benefit analysis, for example, it would have never started in the first place. So the Treasury's Green Book, okay, which is the Green Book where it helps to think about how do we then evaluate whether public investments are getting us the bang for the buck, itself needs to, for example, be thinking about these dynamic spillovers across the whole economy as solutions to the homework problems.
Yeah. You know, a lot of what you say, I totally agree with. And, you know, you can totally see how if you're investing in infrastructure, whatever it is, in the long term, it's going to bring, you know, wealth. It's going to increase everyone's ability to, you know, live a better life. My issue is the people who are deciding what should be invested in don't seem to know enough about the yeah. problems. So, for example, I know you talk about free school meals, and this is something I'm really passionate about. Yeah. And, you know, we've seen this trial happen in London with giving all kids free school meals, and it's gone really well. I've been to various events in the Northeast where I'm from, which is a heavily deprived area, where, there, you know, you don't get free school meals there unless you, you know, you have to fill out various forms. It doesn't really happen. You know, people have, there's a stigma around it. And yet you can see that that is an investment, not a cost. Yeah. That's, you know, if our kids are fed well, they're going to yeah. perform better in school. They're going to be better educated. And that's your point. But my worry is that the politicians don't think like that.
So you've raised so many important points. So first of all, thank you, because it's a perfect example. And it's also an example where sometimes it's the only time that I talk about any other football team except Arsenal, Robert and I. So Marcus Rashford was, you know, yes. it was so important yeah, yeah. what he did during COVID in terms of highlighting, again, how important free school meals were in his home. You know, upbringing, but also how it should not be an option, right? This is an investment. Again, the cost of inaction, even on that, is greater than the cost of action. If kids are not getting a healthy meal and healthy breakfast in the morning, they also won't perform well, and they won't become yeah. productive members, if you want, of our society. And of course, we shouldn't just think about productivity. We should care about the well-being of these students. But how do you then do that? What is a way? I mean, the way I've been thinking about it recently is, how do we create ambitions around the welfare state, for example, around free school meals, and put it at the center of what I called in my book 10 years ago, the entrepreneurial state. So put social challenges at the center of an innovation challenge. So a good example of how that's done well is Sweden. Sweden currently, they've actually adopted this mission-oriented approach, and their high-level challenge is having a fossil-free welfare state, and they land it on the very specifics like school meals. But it's not enough to say free school meals. They say school meals have to be innovative. They have to be healthy, tasty, not just IKEA meatballs, and sustainable. So the procurement, okay, of these school meals becomes part of the innovation budget, right? Mm-hmm. Because companies then have to innovate and invest to create an ambitious, high-quality school meal.
And carbon yeah. neutral is what you're saying, right?
Sustainable, yeah. Carbon neutral, yeah, in terms of the whole supply chain mm-hmm. of the food chain for yeah. school meals. And don't forget that Reagan...
And that's a lot of meals, and so it makes a big contribution.
It's the biggest restaurant chain in the world yeah. in terms of the number of school meals that are produced. I don't know if you remember in the 1980s with the whole budget cuts back then, austerity, Reagan, Thatcher, Reagan said ketchup is a vegetable. Because the opposite of what we're talking about is just reducing yeah. cost immensely. And I remember I used to have a shirt that had ketchup on one side, Reagan on the other, which is the vegetable. Anyway, but so how do we transform ambition around all public services, public transport, public housing, public meals in schools to be part of an innovation economy, which actually cares about people and planet? But the other point you raise, which is very important, is how do we actually get kind of bottom-up participation? So it's not as if it's all top-down ministers telling everyone what's going to be good. Mm. And so an example there is the work that I've done in Camden Council, where I live and work. And with Georgia Gould, we co-chaired the Camden Renewal Commission. And the idea there was to nest this idea of mission orientation in local places. So the housing estates in Camden, we chose 10. And the idea was that, first of all, we bring people through the resident associations and the citizen assemblies to the table to actually debate what is clean growth, what does it mean for our communities. So that's the co-creation side, and get as many different voices to the table. Voice matters. It's not just a tokenistic consultation process. But also, what does it mean to put dignity, self-worth? You were talking about that people sometimes don't feel very good about themselves when they're just accessing,
yeah.
You know, and how do we transform, for example, food banks, which are alive and well in this country because of inequality, which is rising, into food cooperatives, so the people who are actually benefiting from a system have agency in designing the governance of that system. And I can tell you in Camden, literally, the facial expressions of the people running a food cooperative, a green food cooperative in a local housing estate, is completely different from the feelings that people have, right or wrong, when they go into a food bank.
Yeah.
And so bringing so agency about, ownership.
Yeah. Yeah, it's about, in a sense, having a sense that you are running this thing, that you yes. own it, rather than you're just the recipient of other people's charity.
Yeah,
exactly. And that's, you know, then globally, we can look at this in terms of what's called sometimes energy community. So you might have a green industrial strategy, but what does it mean to make sure that the people who are actually creating, for example, renewable energy, whether it's the solar panels on their roofs or other forms, also then are part of the governance structure of a green ecological transition? And there's different conversations like that happening in Brazil today. for example, where Lula has put the ecological transition, first of all, at the center of the economy and the ministry of the economy, but also where the whole issue of how the indigenous communities in the Amazon have been hurt by the lack of a serious green ambition there. What does it mean to bring those voices to the table of Brazil's energy transition?
I mean, can I ask you a question which we don't normally talk to economists about, but it is really important, and you've been thinking about these things for many years, which is really the cultural side of this. When I think about the moonshot, which, I mean, you know, there's an exhibition actually, I mean, King's Cross, about all this, and it's really moving. And I remember as a little boy seeing the moon landing, and it's one of those memories that's just imprinted on me. And the thing that I mostly now reflect on is just the confidence that leaders had back then. We were just in a world where leaders were bolder when it came to making these huge, and I use investment now in the broadest sense of that. Now, obviously, we've talked a bit about how engaging communities so that they feel an ownership in projects is terribly important. But we've also got failure right at the top. How do we change that? You know, we're living in this period of despair. If you poll people, they say nothing's ever going to change. It's just, you know, they have unbelievable disillusionment in the system. How do we change that?
Again, really important question. And I'd say that there's two dimensions of that question. One is that issue of boldness and courage. It's really curious that we only have that when it's related to issues, say, of national security, war.
A crisis.
A crisis like COVID, a health pandemic where millions of people were dying around the world, or a war where we actually care to win. No one has ever said, oh, we're going to war. First of all, oh, there's no tax revenue. Sorry, we can't go now. We'll wait 3 years until we have the revenue. You create the money to go to war. We've always done that. Second, you want to win. So the whole notion of things like outcomes-oriented procurement, of course they're used in war because you want to win.
Was the Vaccine Task Force an example of one of your kinds of missions, as it were? Because you would argue that was pretty successful.
Well, no, it was not successful if the mission was vaccinate the world, which during a global health pandemic should be the mission. We ended up having vaccine nationalism. What worked for one country actually didn't help Africa. And by the way, had COVID begun in Africa, not in China, we would all have been worse off, right? So global health systems matter during a global health pandemic. And if you look at all the recovery funds that happened post-COVID, none of that has gone to strengthening our global health systems. And the next pandemic, unfortunately, we will have them as the permafrost melts, new viruses will come our way. Are we any more prepared now than we were then? No. Look at the digital divide. All these young people who stopped accessing their human right to education during the lockdown. Have we solved that? No. Increase the preparedness of our civil service so we don't have to pay Deloitte $1.5 million a day to do test and trace. By the way, they failed at it. It's not too surprising. They had no expertise in it. We can talk about that later.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's lots of different failures in COVID that we absolutely did not solve. And on vaccines, the point is not just to have vaccines. Mm. We ended up with eight different vaccines. The point, again, is to vaccinate the world. And there, something we haven't talked about yet, the partnership between public and private matters. In the moon landing, they were bold. They said no excess profits. They had that outcomes-oriented procurement. The AstraZeneca vaccine is an interesting example where there was a bit more ambition on the partnership, not because AstraZeneca wanted it, because the Oxford University publicly funded researchers. I have to remind my US colleagues, you know, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, I grew up in Princeton, private universities, Oxford, Cambridge, and many of the best universities in the UK are public state-funded universities. Those researchers were bold. They put conditions attached to the public-private partnership. They said costs and prices must remain low. The knowledge should be shared, you know, issues around patent pools. So that partnership, it's not just about business.
There wasn't political leadership. It was actually these
researchers,
the scientists themselves.
Absolutely. And Pfizer is a company I've been writing about actually for a decade. I often tell my husband if I don't come home at night, it was Pfizer. Have you seen The Constant Gardener? Anyway, Pfizer is one of the most financialized companies in the world, spends much more on share buybacks, for example, to boost stock prices, stock options, and executive pay than on research and development. Of course, they also spend money on research and development, but they have always refused to actually partner in that kind of, I would call it, symbiotic, mutualistic way that AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine would exemplify. That's what we should be talking about. A modern industrial strategy is not only mission-oriented, but requires an ambitious symbiotic public-private partnership instead of a parasitic public-private partnership, which the UK has done very well.
So the question is then, how do we solve these other hugely, I mean, I would argue, you know, that the UK's flatlining prosperity, rising inequality is a crisis.
Sewage in our waters.
These are all crises, but somehow we don't address them as such.
Exactly. And that's the issue. If we don't treat things as urgent problems and time limited, that we actually want to solve those urgent problems in a short amount of time, again, to the moon and back in a short amount of time, winning a war in a short amount of time, we only know how to do that through our kind of military industrial complex kind of thinking. My work has said, if we know how to do it in war, why don't we do it in peacetime? It's not a coincidence that Biden, in his policies, brought up the Defense Production Procurement Act in order to fuel innovation and investment in vaccine production and personal protection equipment production. And even Italy, where I'm from, I have three citizenships, I keep saying this country where I'm from, that country where I'm from. So Italy, US, and UK are my three kind of home countries. Italy is not known for the speed of its, you know, civil service and its government. And yet, you'll remember that COVID struck Northern Italy first, and there was, you know, a lot of deaths early on, and they woke up. They did what Italy never does, which is very quickly fueled, again, an outcomes-oriented industrial strategy, which meant that 137 Italian companies produced the personal protection equipment that was needed that until then was all being produced in China. And they did it through, again, an outcomes orientation, which we tend to only see during wartime. So, and they didn't, by the way, just give it to their friends and family in pubs like they did here.
Yeah, because that, you know, that was obviously a big problem in all of this, was the procurement side of things and, you know, various dodgy contracts.
Yeah.
So how do you get that partnership then between public and private where it doesn't end up being a situation like
a capture.
That? Yeah.
I mean, that's, again, brings us back to that example of school meals, that if it's just seen as a contract without ambition, it's much easier actually to get captured and to introduce corruption. So as soon as you say school meals have to be healthy, tasty, and sustainable, all of a sudden, that's going to require companies to show that they know how to do that. It's not just about creating, you know, ketchup and calling it a vegetable. So that's why also I really believe that a challenge-oriented industrial strategy can do three things. It can help solve problems, because by definition, it's a problem-focused system. It can help fuel that private investment that's required, especially in a country like the UK, which has low business investment. We manage to create profits without investment because we have a financialized form of corporate governance, if you want, I can explain what that is. and three, it can actually ultimately then help produce increases in productivity, which is a key driver of growth. So again, coming back to Rachel Reeves' point that if she wants growth and productivity in this country, the question is, how do you catalyze that private and public investment? And by definition, you can't just be giving contracts to random friends and family that say, I'll, you know, produce some personal protection equipment, because they're not going to be doing it with that strong innovation criteria that has to be at the center of an outcomes orientation.
So what do you think then, just on that, about the National Wealth Fund idea? Because isn't that more linked to the government having, you know, the financial gain from this if the company does well out of something that they've invested in?
So more broadly, it's about public finance. So the way this tends to turn up in the world is through public banks, which the UK is one of the countries that doesn't have a proper public bank. The German public bank is called the KfW. Because Germany does have an outcomes orientation, they made sure that the loans provided from their public bank were conditional on the sectors receiving the loans doing good for the country. So the steel sector, which in the UK, in the US, and in Germany asks for money because steel is in crisis. In Germany, unlike in the UK, the sector received a loan conditional that would lower the material content of production in order to meet the carbon emission targets, which it did through investment in innovation and repurpose, reuse, recycle across the whole innovation chain of steel, which required investment also in training of the workforce. Again, all these things we know also increase productivity and growth. So having a public fund is not a solution if it's just throwing money into the system. Potentially, that can also increase inflation because you're just putting public funds into the system without expanding productive capacity. But that notion of conditionality at the center of loans, grants, guarantees, COVID bailouts that require innovation, that's not currently the way the UK economy works. And on the COVID bailouts, it was really interesting that EasyJet in this country got a loan with no conditions attached, $600 million. Whereas in France, which tends to be a bit more bold and courageous, they put conditions attached to the loans during COVID that were given to the airlines that weren't flying. So Air France car manufacturers, Renault, they had to commit to reducing their carbon emissions in the next 5 years in order to get the government help, which came right away because you need the kind of help right away because your planes aren't flying during COVID, but it was conditional. There was a contract signed. So that idea of having a new social contract, which pre-distributively gets the conditions right between capital and labor, public and private, is again what I think a modern industrial strategy that creates inclusive and sustainable growth must look like.
I think we're going to go to a break now because we've got loads more to ask you, we'll have a quick break.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Welcome back to The Rest Is Money with me, Steph McGovern.
And with me, Robert Peston.
But also with us, Mariana. Do you know what? Just listening to you in that first half, I was just sitting there thinking, can't you be Chancellor? you know what you're talking about. I'm not saying the others don't necessarily, but you know, you've got it sorted. And the other big thing you talk about, and this is in your latest book, isn't it? The Big Con, is about consultancy. You mentioned Deloitte earlier. What are your thoughts on consultancy? You don't necessarily think it works, do you?
They're putting miles.
So first of all, the book is called The Big Con, How the Consulting Industry Has Weakened Our Businesses, Infantilized Our Governments, and Warped Our Economies. And that word infantilization we took from a Tory conservative, Lord Agnew, who on the back of seeing how much money the UK government had spent on consultants, and these are the big consultants, McKinsey, PwC, KPMG, and Deloitte, during both Brexit and COVID, said, what are we doing? We are infantilizing our civil service. These crunchy, wicked problems that they should be solving, we're kind of, you know, outsourcing it to companies that are charging us a lot and not even getting the job done. Deloitte didn't get the job done. And many other types of companies that aren't necessarily consultants, if you think back to G4S getting or Serco getting these contracts where they fail miserably, and whether it's prison services or security during the London Olympics where the government has to bring in the military to do the job because G4S didn't. So that ultra outsourcing of capacity from our civil service, it's a problem when we have hard jobs to be done. It comes back to this point that if we just see the public sector as having to fix a market failure, which is kind of the economics speak, where economists try to sound fancy, so they say stuff like that, as opposed to helping to shape and create an economy that delivers for people and planet, then we've already set up the civil service to fail if we see its ambition as just putting bandages, fixing something, instead of working ambitiously with others. So the book doesn't necessarily criticize consultants or advisors. Head teachers might consult. Doctors and nurses might consult. If a government has a mission around cancer, of course it should be, you know, paying some leading doctors and others to give them some advice. We look at an industry, a very large industry that's almost $1 trillion globally in dollars, that basically has a conflict of interest, right? So when governments work with consultants, the consultants don't, in terms of this large industry, not individuals, but the industry, don't have any incentive to make sure that the government's any smarter in the next round, because then you won't get that contract. Second, the actual value they're bringing, in Italian, we call it aria fritta, fried air. It kind of gives you the sense of there's not much substance there. That's the case of Deloitte. Deloitte didn't have expertise in test and trace. Why would the government have employed them to deliver on a program that there's no kind of legacy that they had ever done that? So then the question is, why are governments so stupid to be doing that? And the answer is, if again, you blame civil servants as soon as they make a mistake, whereas we embrace that kind of underlying risk-taking and experimentation in the private sector, then it's not surprising that A, we don't invest in those capacities and capabilities inside the civil service. But even worse, when we have that capacity, we might not use it because we're worried that if a mistake is, you know, made, then they'll be in the front page of the newspaper. This is a very important point because in Australia, for example, where I just came back last week, they paid McKinsey $6 million to do their climate strategy. They actually had expertise within government through an organization called CSIRO. It's like a research center within government that actually has really strong climate expertise. Why didn't they use them? for their climate strategy. That McKinsey climate strategy did not go down very well. In fact, it was full of holes. But the problem is not that McKinsey then made a mistake. You know, everyone can make a mistake. That's the whole point. But why do we have this need, if you want, to rubber stamp a government strategy with a consultant logo, because it will go down kind of better with the population as opposed to owning these decisions? And the same thing is done in the private sector.
So can I just stop you for a second? Is this back to the thing we were talking about earlier, which is essentially the failure of leadership, that leaders, or you know, people who've got leaders in theory next to their name, just don't want to do what leaders have traditionally done, which is take responsibility?
It's that, so that lack of leadership, but it's also in the last 50 years what we've done to the remit of government. So at the end of Mission Economy, I actually quoted this guy called Ernest Brackett. He was the head of procurement. He's the one who actually got the outcomes-oriented procurement, which led to all those innovations in the private sector. He was in NASA.
Right.
Head of procurement inside the National Space Agency, right, which got us to the moon. And sure, he said, hey, this isn't about public or private, but we inside NASA won't even know how to work with the private sector if we continue to do what he saw was starting in the 1960s, which was to outsource to the consultants a lot of the decision making. And he warned NASA. He said, if we continue, we will ultimately get captured by brochuremanship, which is endearing because they didn't have PowerPoints at the time. They had these shiny brochures that a private company might bring into NASA and say, we'll work with you. And he said, we won't know which private sector companies to work with. We won't know how to write the terms of reference. We won't know how to write good contracts with the private sector if we ourselves don't have brains. So that kind of alarm bell, which is similar then to Lord Agnew's alarm bell of saying that we're infantilizing government, is in fact then what happened. We have infantilized our governments, but it's not because the DNA of the civil service is not able to take risks, or we don't have leadership because the DNA of a minister is not about leading like, you know, like an entrepreneur. It's we've actually created a system where, again, the government see their role as at best fixing market failures. The civil service is scared to take risks. We don't embrace, you know, that kind of experimentation, trial and error and learning from those errors. I'm a big advocate through the institute that I set up at UCL, University College London. It's called the Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose. And we work training civil servants globally in terms of our education system, but also in helping to set up, for example, GovLabs. In Chile, they have a Laboratorio de Gobierno, which is a safe place within government to experiment. How do you do outcomes-oriented procurement during COVID or, you know, having outcomes-oriented budgeting and so on? That requires testing things out. And if you're not allowed to test things out, then that risk averseness is part of the reason we end up having this overuse of consultants. And lastly, I haven't said, and this is very important, there's a huge conflict of interest. You have to choose which side of the street you're on. What instead we often have is consultants.
What do you mean by that?
Well, an example would be that you're advising or consulting both with McKinsey, the climate strategy in Australia, and with the biggest fossil fuel companies and carbon polluters.
You mean the same consultancy?
The same consultancy company working both with the regulators and with those that should be regulated. This is common practice. PwC, it just came out recently, we're working with the medical device companies and the regulators of the medical devices. In South Africa, they were working with Eskom, the large state-owned enterprise for energy, and the Treasury, which is supposed to
be. So they're basically providing contradictory arguments depending on who
they're on both sides of the street. To be honest, is not so hard to solve. It should just be outright illegal. The bigger problem of what have we done to our civil service that has made it so risk averse and we're not investing within those dynamic capabilities is something much harder to solve, but we must do it.
I think I have an example of where this has worked from my career. So I used to work for an engineering company, and one of the things they did, I worked in procurement as part of so I did like it was like an apprenticeship. So I did a stint in different departments. And one of the departments was procurement. And we worked out there was this company that supplied us that was, you know, working 24/7, but still wasn't producing enough of the product. And what they did is, and I think this is where your innovation point comes in, is they got us kind of young students to see if we could, you know, look at how this company, you know, whether we needed to find other companies to produce this product or whether we could work within this company to help them produce them faster. Mm-hmm. And then that's basically what we did. There was a gang of us who got trained in like just-in-time production, it's stuff called Six Sigma and all of that. And because we were like at the lower end of the pay, it didn't really matter whether we failed or not on this. And then I ended up working with this supplier company and you know, we did this whole Six Sigma project and it worked and the company ended up being able to produce these. It was like an impeller fan off a thing that sucks up leaves in your garden. And they managed to make them within the 5-day week so they could close the factory at weekends and they were producing enough. But that came from the company going, let the kids, for want of a better word, have a go at doing it. And so I was like, that, you know, that kind of plays to your point about if companies are more innovative in how they think about where their solution's going to come from. Yes. They could have brought in consultants.
And this is a trend, by the way, that's happening now globally. I was just this morning before going on air with you, speaking to the German government. They've actually tried to change this over-reliance on consultants by actually creating an internal team of young, bright people like yourself.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that. But
anyway.
The thing that worked about it, I think, was it was young people who didn't have the weight of, you can't do that with the machine, love. Yeah. Or, you know, they didn't have all of that.
But that's what DARPA has done. You know, DARPA is why we have the internet, right? The internet and everything in your smartphone that makes it smart and not stupid was actually publicly financed. I wrote about this in the Entrepreneurial State, from organizations in the public sector that were, again, outcomes problem oriented, almost always military industrial complex, right? So again, how do we apply that to social problems? But what's interesting is then you look at DARPA, which was one of those organizations in the Defense Department, called the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, got us the internet. Why? Because they had a problem to solve. They needed to get the satellites to communicate. Internet was the answer. GPS, same thing. But with the Navy, the CIA got us touchscreen. So be careful when you touch your... Anyway, but the point is, then look at those organizations. You know, why did someone want to work inside DARPA and not in some sort of tech company?
Yeah.
It was actually the internal culture. And they bring in people for 5 years and say, be crazy, be nutty. You will actually be promoted based on how much risk you're willing to take and how much economy-wide impact your successes have. So if you're just playing it safe, you will get fired. They want people to come in. And, you know, in the UK, they tried to do this now with ARIA, or I always pronounce everything in Italian, right? ARIA, right? Which is the UK version of DARPA. And actually, a friend of mine, Elon Gur, is running it. But it doesn't make any sense to have an ARIA unless you have problems to be solved. And if the biggest problem we have here are things like Brexit, it's not going to work. The reason DARPA worked, it was linked with big, bold problems that had to be solved, bringing in people, often through secondment, for 5 years, telling them to take those big bets on big problems that needed to be solved, measuring their success based on that kind of risk-taking, and linking that with things like procurement, right? Which then allowed some small companies that were getting funded to scale up, not just starting up. I've never understood why we obsess about startups. It's scaling up that matters. And for that, you need these demand side levers, which bold procurement policy in the US has always helped to foster. So the US is just ridiculous that we have described it as a market-led model. It is the most interventionist of all countries, besides communist countries. and it did that through a decentralized network of active problem-based public agencies, and they talked Jefferson, but they acted Hamilton.
I mean, I think in fairness, you know, they are trying to do that with ARIA. I just think the funding is way too small for starters, and they're not quite ambitious enough in terms of the problems they're trying to solve.
Well, ARIA is, but the government isn't. So unless the government actually has big, bold problems, you don't need an ARIA. What's the point of having an idea?
Well,
it's not like, you know, Dominic Cummings actually once brought me into Downing Street. He said, love your work. Come in. You know, we need geeks in government. I was like, dude, that is not the problem. Like, you're not going to get geeks in government by saying we need geeks in government. You're going to get geeks to want to work with government if you have crazy problems that you say, come and help us. That's why Obama was able to get Steve Chu, a Nobel Prize winning Chinese-American physicist, to become the Minister of Energy. Sure. He would have preferred to stay in Stanford had the objective been, oh, come and help stimulate innovation in the tech community. Be like, yeah, right, whatever. I'll do that on the outside. What Obama said is we're going to have, while the UK is out there doing austerity and Europe is too, we're going to have an $800 billion stimulus program after the financial crisis. We're going to direct it towards greening our economy. Then the Tea Party got in the way, but that was the ambition. They ended up then using their loan programs to fund companies like Tesla, which at the time would not have gotten off, you know, without that. And this guy, Steve Chu, was at the center of it. And the first thing he did was to set up ARPA-E, which is like an ARIA for the energy transition. He would have never come in to do that had it been come in and fix a market failure. It was help us steer a big, bold recovery. And this is what Rachel Reeves and the Labour Party need to realize. Yeah. First of all, you need a big, bold investment program. It needs public and private sector investment. You need an active civil service. But the best way to do that is also to make it ambitious in terms of what the role of government is.
Can I just ask you on a kind of human level, you know, you mentioned various kind of politicians and people you've worked with over the years. Does it do your head in when they don't listen to you?
Well, first of all, being a woman on the progressive side of the political spectrum, where governments actually do what or try to do, I'm lucky. You know, what I've written has actually, you know, in Europe now we have a mission-oriented instrument. $30 billion in the Horizon program is for the missions because of the work I did. So if governments are trying to do what you've done and you even go in the media, right, you get a lot of hate.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, just like I'm sure you know, we know also that women journalists. So just to say, the point is not just to, you know, have these great stories. It's also about how do we make sure that we have alliances that go against what has been called the merchants of doubt, right? There's a lot of skepticism in the system. And when you have someone like myself and others with a positive narrative, it's an optimistic narrative, it's we can do better. There are these problems, but don't think they're deterministic. They're outcomes of how we've designed our system. Then those who are happy with the system as it is will do their best to discredit you. So just to put it out there, because that really is the biggest battle. Then I tend to work with governments. I'm currently working with Barbados simply because the Prime Minister, Mia Motley, is an absolute hero.
Yeah.
And I just feel so lucky to be able to talk to her, you know, weekly and to go to Barbados because it's also a great country. But the ambition that she has both for changing the international financial architecture, especially having a green and blue industrial strategy, she wants to make Barbados the most sustainable island, large ocean state, not small island state.
Yeah.
So again, the ambition, which means changing how hotels work instead of an extractive machine. How do we make sure they are investing within their own workforce to create green supply chains throughout the whole tourism industry? So anyway, Barbados, Colombia, very interesting. But Brazil really is where a lot of my energy right now is because, you know, it's a new government, relatively new after a pretty horrific experience that they had with Bolsonaro. But it's hard. None of this is easy. You know, again, that interdepartmental way of thinking of the ecological transition. How do you think of growth as an outcome of actually stimulating public and private investment in agribusiness and the biodiversity in the Amazon, not just protecting the Amazon, but making it at the center of an innovation strategy? All these things to me are fascinating. So I tend to work with governments also where I can learn, humbly shutting up a bit, listening to the civil servants that have come in, you know, through an honor of actually working with an administration that cares to put, again, people and planet at the center of a growth strategy.
Yeah.
And you have got, you've talked about the hate, but you've also got some quite high profile fans, including the Pope, I understand.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, when I wrote, okay, this is back some time, The Value of Everything, I'm not sure how he got a hold of it, but he then gave a speech in Argentina saying, you know, capitalism is all messed up, but hey, there's a book. So that kind of woke me up to the fact that this Pope, Pope Francis, had actually read some of my work, and that was immediately interviewed about that. And people said, have you met him? I said, no, but I'm very glad he's reading my books. But then he invited me to be a part of his Academy of Life. And I, again, got a lot of hate because of life, right? And if you think of how the Vatican and the religious right has thought about life, it hasn't exactly been progressive. So in fact, he got a lot of critique for that. The extreme right wing of the Catholic Church, especially in the U.S., said, oh, how can you put a atheist abortionist? I'm not sure where they got that. They just figured she's on the left. She must love abortion and love being an atheist. Anyway, they made that up. He then gave a couple speeches where he reminded everyone. He said, I've put Mariana Mazzucato on the Academy of Life because her economics is economics for humanity. And then the funny thing is I then visited him and he, you know, told me some nice things. And then he waved his finger and he said in Spanish, but they tell me you're not that religious. And then I just met him recently, 2 weeks ago, because I presented some work on the common good. That's actually my new book I'm writing on the economics of the common good. And I gave him a paper I wrote on it. And he, again, you know, said some complimentary things and then looked at me and said, but you do have 4 kids, they tell me, which must be good. Yeah. Have more kids.
So we are almost out of time. So I'm just going to plant a thought probably for our next conversation. One of the things that Steph and I are both very worried about is this, as we go through this generative AI industrial revolution, how we prevent the supernormal profits that are likely to be generated. Well, just, you know, how do we make sure that this industrial revolution helps people and not just increases inequality? And, you know, how do we stop all the revenue going right to the top to a few owners?
Yeah. And again, so I actually have a project on this called algorithmic rents. So the old rents in the system were, you know, from the landlords, which the physiocrats were writing about in the 1700s. They talked about the sterile system when you have landlords taking money out of the system, not reinvesting. Modern day rents are done through the financial sector, through the pharmaceutical industry, and through these companies we call big tech. And on the big tech side, this project I have called algorithmic rents looks at how the algorithms themselves are designed are part of that rent seeking. So Shoshana Zuboff has written about this in Surveillance Capitalism. She says, you think you're searching Google for free. Well, guess what? Google is searching you for free. So how do we tackle the design of the algorithms in, again, a pre-distributive ex-ante way, as opposed to always thinking that these processes are neutral and we're going to pick up the pieces at the end? That does not work.
No, I agree with you, which is why we've got to sort it now.
We've got to sort it now, but we also have to, I come back to this talent issue. I can't, you know, overstate how much that's a problem. If all the deep knowledge about AI used to be a bit distributed, yes, in the private sector, but also in our top universities and public labs, like it was with the internet, again, DARPA, a public laboratory, basically got us the internet, then we have a problem. And these excess profits, these rents in the system that are paying huge salaries to researchers who then leave Stanford, leave Cambridge, and go work for Microsoft, for Google, and OpenAI, and so on. That is part of the problem. But the question we have to be asking is, where did that money come from? Imagine, I mean, this is why I should also write something about philanthropies. We currently have a system where corporate governance is one of the Amazon model. You know, watch the Ken Loach film on this, right? You know, Amazon drivers have to pee in bottles, right? Because of how stressful their work is. Amazon doesn't pay tax. We know that. They also have a very financialized model. So that creates excess profits in the system, rents. Then they put 1% of that, if that, into a foundation called the Bezos Earth Fund, which then works with the United Nations on climate change. I mean, that is not a good way to tackle our global problems. How do you tackle it from the start, making sure those excess rents are not there in the first place? Once Amazon pays their workers well, improves working conditions, and pays their tax, let's see how much is left over to then put into a foundation. And then, of course, we need good foundations, of which there are many in the world, to work with good government and good business to solve our problems. But these excess rents that we have in the system have to be tackled from how do we produce value in the first place in a good way, as opposed to allowing that and then, you know, draining out the top talent from our universities because you're being given millions instead of an academic salary.
Well, there's a lot we can chew through there, isn't there? Thank you so much, Mariana. It's been totally fascinating. And I think, you know, everyone's going to go away thinking
exhausted
about things.
I mean, I thought this was going to be a quickie.
Lots of strands, you know, for everybody to think about. And we'll definitely have you back.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Exhausting pleasure. Amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that was an amazingly gripping, wide-ranging discussion. What did you make of it?
Yes, she's amazing, isn't she? I think fundamentally, I just want to be her. Like, she's so articulate, isn't she? She's just bilingual. She pretty much knows every single political leader in the world. And
they all come to her for advice.
Yeah, including the Pope, which was a cracking story. No, but I think fundamentally, it's really refreshing to hear someone who I agree with in terms of, you know, I do think we need to put money into investment on our infrastructure and things in order to get growth. And that's where it'll come from. And, you know, that whole idea that growth isn't the mission, growth is the outcome. That makes sense, doesn't it?
No, she's completely right about that. But the simple point seems to me to be the one that one has to not let go of, which is we need leadership and we need those people, whether they're at the top of governments or the top of public sector, to be less scared of failure and to take more risk.
A bit like us, really.
I think we take enough risk, don't we? I mean, we're out there every week saying things that many people think are dumb, but we're sticking to our guns.
Yeah, we certainly are. And we'll have more coming your way soon. But that's it from us on the Rest Is Money. Send us your thoughts, restismoney@gmail.com, or you can contact us on our social media pages as well. But that's it from us. Bye-bye.
See you next week.